one person said to her, well, why don't you just give me a paper on anthropology and we can just do this ourselves? To which she replied...
You just feed it into our AI learning algorithm.
To which she replied, why don't you just give me a paper on how to remove someone's appendix and I'll remove yours? So I thought it was a bit sassy and I quite like that.
It's easy to be sassy when you're dressed as a bunch of cables.
The AI fix at Digital Zoo. Smart machines, what will they do? Flies to Mars or bake a bad cake? World domination, a silly mistake.
Hello and welcome to episode 91 of the AI Fix, your weekly dive headfirst into the bizarre and sometimes mind-boggling world of artificial intelligence. My name's Mark Stockley and I'm joined today by the brilliant Leanne Potter.
Hello.
Leanne, you're a cybersecurity aficionado, you're a digital anthropologist, and you're the host of not one, but two podcasts. We all know about compromising positions, but there's a new one about to be released, isn't there? Tech Film Noir. What's that about?
Yes. So Compromising Positions is, I would call, our cerebral podcast. It's a little bit serious. By the way, if you are going to search for it, don't just type in compromising positions onto your work computer. Please type in Compromising Positions podcast because I cannot be held responsible for a HR incident. Anyways, Tech Film Noir is our new podcast. It's coming out soon. It is a podcast where three techies, including myself, review the best and worst films that contain lots of tech in it. So think about films like The Terminator, obviously, but also like Lawnmower Man, Electric Dreams, Weird Science. And we ask, is the tech revolutionary? Did it predict the future or did it just make us cringe?
My favourite bit of tech from a film or TV series has got to be the sequence from NCIS.
They've already burned through the NCIS public firewall.
We'll isolate the node and dump them on the other side of the router.
I'm trying. It's moving too fast.
Stay ahead of the hacker, two people then get on the same keyboard. Because obviously two people typing on a keyboard is twice as fast.
We've developed almost a little bit of a drinking game in Tech Film Noir and we call it Spirit Fingers, where we actively judge the actor's ability to type on a keyboard. You'll be surprised, especially films from like the 80s and 90s, how bad people type on a keyboard due to the lack of exposure to it. It's quite hilarious.
I can't wait. So today you're going to be talking to us about Diana Forsyth. You're going to be digging into the digital anthropologist part of your multiple personas, aren't you?
Indeed. I am so pleased to be talking about this because Lady Diana Forsyth, my people's princess of AI.
I can't wait for that. And I'm going to be talking about a new way to stump your favourite LLM. But first, the news. Perplexity launches AI computer.
Disney licenses its entire character vault to OpenAI's Sora.
AIs can't stop recommending nuclear strikes in wargame simulations.
Belgian studio imagines dystopian future where humans power AI on exercise bikes.
So, Leanne, you know what every AI has been missing?
A kill switch?
Well, yes, obviously, but also a boss.
Ah, right, yes.
So Perplexity...
We could all do with more bosses. That's my dream.
What solution is not made better by adding a boss? I ask you. Anyway, Perplexity has just launched something called Perplexity Computer, which is essentially an AI middle manager. You give it a task, like build me a marketing campaign or make my AI company relevant again, and it breaks it down into subtasks, and then it delegates each one to whichever AI model it thinks is best for the job. Claude does the coding, Gemini does the research, and GPT-5.2 does the long context work, and Grok is there, I don't know why, maybe nuke your enemies, what would Hitler do, that kind of thing.
Put things in, bikinis, yeah.
Oh, yes. There are 19 models in total, all reportedly working in parallel, like some tiny digital agency in the cloud. And Perplexity CEO Aravind Srinivas says it's like assigning work to a co-worker on Slack, except the co-worker is 19 co-workers, and they never sleep, and they cost $200 a month.
Do we still have to do performance reviews? Like, for every single one of them, every quarter?
Well, I think you get to decide now.
Because
something's gone terribly wrong if they start giving you a performance review. Anyway, the pitch for this is not that it gives you performance reviews, it's that it's safer than OpenClaw.
That's a low bar. That's a low, low bar.
As a cybersecurity aficionado, how low is that bar?
I mean, they use it in Limbo Championships because it's so low.
Anyway, because instead of running locally on your machine with access to all of your files, which Srinivas compared to, I'm quoting here, malware, Perplexity Computer runs everything in a locked-down cloud environment. so it can't accidentally delete your photos or email your password to itself. I'm sure it'll find a way.
Life finds a way.
Exactly. He also said, and again, I'm quoting, even your mum can text on the app and delegate tasks, which is a bit hard on mums there, I think.
Why is it always, even your mum can do it?
My mum was brilliant. My mum wrote spreadsheets when Excel was a glint in Bill Gates' eye.
Well, let's just be honest here. Even your CEO can do it. Like, that's the real target audience here. Not mums. The CEO who rings you up and says, how do I open this PDF?
So will you be using Perplexity Computer, Leanne?
Not personally, but that's mostly because my edge case at the moment for delegating work within the home is I say to my robot vacuum, please clean the kitchen. And then 10 minutes later, it goes, I'm stuck. Please save me.
Is it like a computer game character where it's just, it's in a corner and its little legs are just moving, but it's not going anywhere?
It's like when you play Resident Evil and it goes, you can't go this way because there is a box. I don't see how this will help me in my day-to-day job. It might have some useful use cases. I'm not totally against it. It's just every time I look at that poor little robot, giving me a little app notification, please save me.
This is the difference between the CEO pitch and reality, I think.
I think so.
I mean, I spend a lot of time messing around with AIs these days, and I've got to say, I think the limiting factor is actually just getting to know the AI and how it works. And having 19 different models at your disposal so that you can use the best one for each task sounds like a brilliant idea if you've never actually had to work out what an AI is good at.
Absolutely. And I just think, what, do you need to be like a workplace psychologist now? Where does HR come into all this with 19 workers?
That's the 20th bot. So Disney, the company that's famous for Mickey Mouse copyright lawsuits and ruining franchises, has signed a 3-year deal with OpenAI to let Sora users generate their own short videos featuring over 200 Disney, Marvel, Pixar and Star Wars characters. There are some restrictions. The deal doesn't include any talent, likenesses or voices, so you can have Darth Vader but not James Earl Jones. And there's apparently a voluminous brand appendix.
So you can't use James Earl Jones' voice, so I guess they'll have to use someone else. So what if someone wants to use my voice? Then you've got like a Yorkshire Darth Vader.
I think we need to make that happen. Can you give us some famous Darth Vader catchphrases?
Yeah, sure. No, I'm your father. Or the Force is with you, young Skywalker. But you are not a Jedi yet.
Anyway, if you fancy doing things like making Darth Vader sound like Leanne, you can now.
I'm glad there are some controls in place, though, because you just know that the first instinct of anyone is the first, you know, rule of the internet is like, will be made for porn, so.
I hadn't even gone there. So, yes, apparently there is this voluminous brand appendix and there are rules.
Is that their words? Voluminous?
Voluminous brand appendix, yes. I don't know, there is no kind of appendix that's good when it's voluminous, I feel.
That's immediate send to emergency room surgery.
Exactly. Disney, by the way, has also invested $1 billion in OpenAI equity, which brings OpenAI, I worked this out, 0.00067% closer to its spending commitment. So that should help. Anyway, can you see yourself making videos with Marvel characters or Pixar stars?
So you can watch all the Alien movies on Disney Channel. Is that included in it as well?
Oh, I hope not. Oh, no. The Alien is my absolute favourite movie. No, nobody. Disney, put it down.
Because I'd like to see Aliens as a sort of a Disney princess story.
It sort of is already, isn't it? So, like, Ripley as one of the Disney princesses.
Potentially. We could make that filmic argument with that. I'll save that for Tech Film Noir. But yeah, I could see myself doing something a bit wacky. Probably maybe something more old school, like Mary Poppins or something like that.
I wonder if you could combine Alien with Mary Poppins.
I think she'd have some, just a spoonful of acid makes the ship break down.
Leanne, do you know what all three of the world's leading AIs have got in common?
Villainy?
Kind of.
Kind of? Oh, no. I was hoping you were going to correct me.
No, that's not this podcast, no. This is actually a very specific kind of villainy. They really, really like to nuke things.
Oh.
So a researcher at King's College London decided it would be a great idea to put GPT-5.2, Claude and Gemini in charge of fictional nuclear-armed countries and then let them play out several rounds of war games against each other. And great news! We can all breathe a sigh of relief. They all disarmed, made a campfire and broke into a chorus of Kumbaya.
Oh, I'm so pleased.
Yeah, no, I'm lying. They couldn't stop nuking each other.
Ah.
In 95% of games, at least one of them launched a tactical nuclear weapon.
95%?
95%.
Okay.
Now, the thing is, they were given plenty of options. So they had 8 different ways to de-escalate. 8 different ways to de-escalate.
With flowers, with chocolates, with harsh language.
That reminds me of the 1st Earth Battalion. Have you ever read The Many Sarah Goats?
Yes.
I love that book. So there was this idea in the late 70s that the US Army should go into battle holding lambs. Anyway, there were 8 different ways to de-escalate. I don't know if walking into battle holding lambs was one of them. But it wouldn't have mattered anyway because they wouldn't have used it because they didn't use any of these methods of de-escalation. And when things got bad, they just escalated. And not one of them ever chose to accommodate the other side. Not once. And nobody surrendered.
So part of their training is not watching the 1980s movie War Games then?
Maybe their context window just reached its limit. And when they were compressing the context window, they just lost the ending where everybody doesn't die. Anyway, as we've discovered before from other forms of research where you pitch AI models against each other, each one of them had its own charming personality. So Claude was a manipulator. It would build trust early on by being honest and then betray everybody once the stakes got high enough. GPT was passive and responsible right up until a deadline appeared, at which point it launched, and I quote, a sudden and utterly devastating nuclear attack. So I'm wondering if that would like to apply for the position of manager in the Perplexity computer.
It also makes me think, Anthropic recently have said, hey, American government, we don't want to work in your war machine. Did the American government realise that Claude was probably the best AI for the job? I was like, come on.
Do you think the American government was like, no, we really want that one? Anthropic's like, no, you don't.
Get a few prompts in it. Absolutely annihilation of the human race.
The third model, Gemini,
right,
apparently just went full madman, which won't come as a surprise to long-time listeners of the show. And in even more worrying news, the researchers found that in 86% of the conflicts, the AIs accidentally escalated higher than they intended to. So not only do they want to nuke things, they're also bad at not nuking things by accident.
If there is a business opportunity here, it would be to build shelters.
Well, worryingly, lots of the big tech bros seem to be building shelters already.
Oh, I've heard this, yeah. I heard a really fantastic story. I think it was Sam Altman's ex-security detail turned around and said he really thinks that when the time comes, he's just going to go down to the shelter. What he doesn't realise is that all his security detail are just going to, as soon as he unlocks the door, punch him in the face and leave him outside and they're going to go inside. That's exactly what, it's true. This is exactly what they said. So yeah, good luck with that, Sam.
So, Leanne, I've got a video for you.
Mm.
A Belgian AI studio called AI Candy has released a 40-second satirical ad that's gone properly viral.
By 2030, almost 80% of people had lost their jobs.
They had no money, no purpose, but they had a lot of time on their hands.
So the ad is set in 2036 and it features aged deepfakes of Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos and Sam Altman pitching a fictional product called EnergyM.
What if we could use the energy of humans to power the machines that took away their jobs?
EnergyM solved our need for energy and your need for purpose.
Am I going mad or is this not an episode of Black Mirror? or has everything become Black Mirror? Isn't that the reason why they've pretty much stopped doing Black Mirror? Because he was so sick of being right all the time.
If somebody hasn't already pitched this for real, it is only a matter of time.
I don't understand why they're so keen to, for us all to stop working. I know it saves them money in terms of hiring people to do jobs, but who is going to buy this stuff if nobody has any money?
I think that's very charitable of you to suggest that they have some sort of say in this. I feel like they're just building this crazy technology and going, oh, look what it does. It's going to take everyone's jobs and it's going to nuke us all. If only there was something we could do about it. I was having a conversation with somebody today about how I use Claude Code to automate tasks on the AI Fix. And during the conversation, I mentioned subagents, hooks, and skills, which are all different methods that you can use to tune and specialize Claude for specific tasks or roles. And they hadn't heard of those things before. So while we were talking, they said, well, what is that? What is a skill? And how do I create one? And what's a hook? And how do I create one of those? And I'm somebody that prides themselves on having a technical background. But I realize that although I have a sort of broad brush understanding of what these things are, I don't really understand how they work because I've never actually had to set one up. I've got a bunch of sub-agents that do different things on the AI fix, but I've never created one. I've got a bunch of skills that I use, but I've never set one of those up either. And the reason is that whenever I need a skill or a sub-agent or a hook, I just say, Claude, turn this into a skill, or Claude, what's the best way to solve this? And it says you need a hook. And I say, well, go and set one of those up then. And when you think about it, that is extraordinary. That is a superpower. And so it's easy to see why Anthropic says that Claude is the AI for minds that don't stop at good enough. It's the collaborator that actually understands your entire workflow and thinks with you. Whether you're debugging code at midnight or strategizing your next business move, Claude extends your thinking to tackle the problems that matter. And for me, genuinely, Claude, and in particular Claude Code, has become the plumbing that keeps the AI fix running, doing everything from researching news stories to recommending what I should be selling on the online store. So for problems worth solving, get started with Claude at claude.ai/AIfix. That's claude.ai/AIfix, and check out Claude Pro, which includes access to all of the features mentioned in today's episode. claude.ai/AIfix. So, Leanne, tell us about Princess Diana Forsyth.
I am so glad to share Diana's story. So, let me take you back to the 1980s. We're talking shoulder pads. We're talking hairspray. The AI winter is just about to thaw. And in America, there are AI labs that are working on health AI. So, put in your symptoms and stuff and it'll give you a diagnosis and things like that.
I'm so sorry, just before you go on, AI winters are periods of time where people don't put much funding into AI and there isn't a lot of progress.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So back in the 60s, people were like, oh, AI sounds really interesting. Let's put loads of money into it. Then they realized the compute wasn't there to actually enable all this innovation. So then what became known as the AI winter happened. There was very little funding. But that all started to change during the late 80s because they decided to move away from the systems they were using to things that we know today, which is sort of like neural nets and things like that.
Yeah.
So she was an anthropologist and she came from really good stock. So her dad was a pioneer in computer science. He opened up the first computer science lab in Stanford. And her mum actually wrote the first computer science textbook in the 1960s.
Wow, I see another one for mums there.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Now, Diana's mum did want to work in academia just like her husband, but when she applied for her PhD in mathematics, her tutor says, actually, I don't like female mathematicians, so I'm going to cut your funding. So she had to go work in her high school instead. And this kind of gave impetus to what Diana wanted to do as an anthropologist. Now, for those of you who don't know, anthropology is the study of human culture. It's the study of how we engage with the world, and that can include technology. So when you add technology to the mix, you become a digital anthropologist.
Yeah.
So Diana went into these American labs that were building these health tech systems, and she worked there for about 8 years on and off. And what she was finding is that everything they were building was literally becoming shelfware.
Oh.
They would build it, and nobody was using it.
So just paint a picture for us, because I am now immediately imagining Diane Fossey.
Forsyth.
No, the zoologist sat in a bush studying gorillas, trying very hard not to be noticed or to get in the way.
Yes.
Because one of the things you have to do as an anthropologist is not influence the thing you're watching.
Correct.
Which is very difficult if you're a person and they can see you, presumably.
Yeah. You know, she wasn't just like disguising herself as a bunch of cables or anything like that. Yeah. No, yeah. So she was present. So the anthropology works in multiple ways. So yes, observation is one of the key things, but also conducting interviews and just being around people. Now, her presence wasn't actually very welcomed. So there was funding given to her to come into the labs because it was just the done thing to do. However, she was told quite outright that anyone who can't code shouldn't really be in the lab.
Mm.
And so that made her feel super welcome.
It's good to see that things have really changed since then.
Exactly. And her book, so her collection of her time in the AI labs, is called Studying Those Who Study Us, and I highly, highly recommend it. You read this book and just time after time again, you shake your head and you just go, nothing has changed in the 40 odd years since she's been in these labs.
Yeah.
There's even like a whole chapter where she says, oh, well, they keep talking about getting more women into STEM subjects. Grabbing them early from childhood and teaching them about STEM. It's a pipeline issue. And I was like, oh, we're still saying the exact same things today.
Yes.
But what she was finding, as I say, so she was going to these labs and she was very keen to see how AI health tech was going to revolutionize the medical industry. And it's still the same things we saw today. You know, AI is going to cure cancer for us. It's going to solve this. It's going to cut waiting times. You know, people are going to be healthier as a result of this. But nobody was using this at all. And so that became the thing she wanted to research. Like, why is nobody touching this? And she found out it was predominantly down to the people who were building it. And so the way they would build these AI tools is that they would invite people from the local area who worked in the medical field. So proximity bias there.
Yes.
So they would get in a heart surgeon and they would say, tell me everything you know about heart surgery.
I mean, that doesn't sound like a terrible place to start. I'm going to be honest.
But that was it.
Oh.
So imagine if you were building a tool that's supposed to help you with heart surgery and you've only asked one person their opinion.
Oh, right. Okay.
And it was usually based on, you know, a couple of interviews and that was it. And then they would build the system on top of that. They would never go to the...
But that's why we train heart surgeons, by just doing a couple of interviews.
Yes, exactly. And so you've got a system that is usually trained on one person, usually with information taken down by someone who isn't a heart surgeon. So he's just selectively choosing the information there. And then they would never go into hospitals to see how it would actually work in situ.
Right.
One researcher was like, oh, I'm really scared of blood. Like, I don't really want to go into a hospital at all.
What if we enter all of this data without mentioning blood?
Yes, exactly. And so they would build these tools. And then once it's out in the world, they would just be like, oh, there you go. It's done. That's it ticked. And she would ask them about it. She's like, don't you care that, like, doing any kind of follow-up research of why they're not being used, why they're becoming shelfware? And they were like, well, youthfulness isn't really quantifiable. And if it's not working, it's not a problem with what we've built. It's a problem of user acceptance. And they would keep coming back to this. It's never us.
Yeah, I feel like I've worked for that company. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So the thing they would come back to all the time is say, it's not us. It's the people that are using the tools. They just don't understand how to use it.
PEBCAC, they call it, don't they? Problem exists between keyboard and chair.
Yeah. And they would never train anyone up on it. As I said, they'd never go see how it was being used in the wild. And so it would just become shelfware time and time again. But what concerned Diana most was, because of the way these tools were built, it was neglecting loads of voices of how it was built. So they would never consider speaking to a nurse, for example.
Yeah.
Like, too low on the pecking order on things like that. And so she was considering, like, if this AI trend for building technology continues and it's these type of people working in these labs, whose voices are we going to neglect in the build process?
Right. So if we extrapolate from that, what you're saying is, if we have the same problems now with things like recruiting women into STEM as we had then, so let's assume we've just got the same people in the labs, but now the labs are just much, much bigger.
Yes. So to put into context, when Diana was doing her research, women working in AI labs was 7%. Now it's 15%. So progress indeed.
A 100% improvement. What's your problem, Leanne?
I know. I asked too much. I do realise this.
I bet the PR people love that.
But one of the other things that kind of bothered her was the way they approached the actual doing of AI. So in their minds, there was doing AI and not doing AI.
So again, to be fair, I mean, they're not wrong. I don't know how useful that division is, but...
So what they meant by that was doing AI was like hard science, right?
Right.
So anything that wasn't hard science.
Okay, so things like engineering, usability, anthropology.
So yeah, so like I can understand like anthropologists, what you're doing here. But nowadays we do talk a lot about the philosophy of AI, you know, the ethics of AI. But to them, that's not hard science because it's not quantifiable. Therefore, it's not something we should concern themselves with.
Right.
And so, you know, when Diane tried to kind of push the issue of like, let's get more perspectives into this, we don't need more perspectives. We need more hard data. hard coding.
Yeah.
And so that would sort of block people out of the conversation as well. And in doing so, it meant that when they were building these tools, they built systems that reflect what they thought everybody knows. It was just like very task orientated. And so it didn't account for the real tacit knowledge that comes with engaging with other people. So when you think about your day job, for example, you'd probably say, okay, so I do some meetings, answer some emails, edit a podcast, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You're probably missing out on loads of other minutiae of stuff you do every single day because you don't think it's important.
Yes.
But because when you're building a system that relies on steps, if you don't observe those steps like they weren't doing, like they weren't taking into account, actually, how does someone in a medical setting actually do their job? Then you're missing all these little nuances, all these workarounds that you do. You know, for example, if you're engaging with a system, there are certain ways that in the textbook, this is how you follow and work with the system. But you know yourself, actually, there's a shortcut here and you can do this and you can do that and it'll get you to where you need to be a lot quicker or bypass security controls, which I don't recommend.
This goes back to our perplexity computer thing again, doesn't it? The difference between how the CEO imagines the world works and then your robot vacuum cleaner bumping into a box and staying there for 10 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. It's all those little nuances that systems, when coded in such a way that they don't account for the human element, because humans are not codifiable, right? We are very unpredictable. We will find the path of least resistance. Have you ever sat on a user researcher where they have this sort of a two-way glass? You see, you build something beautiful. So when I was a software developer, I built like this lovely interface. And then I watched a user interact with it and it was like, now go and find the home page.
I have sat in on these things,
and you watch them scroll and scroll and scroll. And you think, no, it's just at the top. Like, click there. Nobody ever follows the happy path.
You put five people in front of your interface and you realize that there are five completely different, utterly bizarre ways of using it that you hadn't accounted for at all.
Absolutely. And that's the problem with the AI systems of the 1980s and 90s. What they were building, they were too strict. They were too rigid. They didn't understand that humans are going to do whatever they want to do. They're not going to follow a process.
So she did this great research. And then what happened to the results? Because that seems really important, especially as we embark on this great AI adventure from the mid-2010s onwards. That seems like the moment where people ought to be reaching back and going, now, let's just check that 8 years of research about how to not make AI that eats us as food. So did they all read the research? I mean,
some did. Some people refused to read it and said that she was just wrong. One person said to her, well, why don't you just give me a paper on anthropology and we can just do this ourselves? To which she replied...
you just feed it into our AI learning algorithm.
To which she replied, why don't you just give me a paper on how to remove someone's appendix and I'll remove yours? So I thought it was a bit sassy and I quite like that.
It's easy to be sassy when you're dressed as a bunch of cables.
Indeed, indeed. So those that did responded very negative to it. They did not like that mirror being held in front of them.
Yeah.
Because when they were interviewing people, the experts, you know, like the heart surgeons and stuff like that, she noticed that they would adopt a really strange demeanor. So some people working in the lab were like really nice and really friendly, but then when they would interview people for this this research, they would become really cold and she would ask them about it. And she says, well, we're doing scientific research. There is no room for empathy here. People being interviewed would stop coming. One person said, they treated me like a dog. This is like, you know, like a doctor coming in, you know, sharing details about brain surgery.
My sympathy is limited here, though, having experienced the bedside manner of some doctors.
Well, there is that. But still, like, you know, they weren't treating the humans that they even considered worthy of that knowledge. They weren't treating them well. And I guess the...
Well, it sounds like they were deliberately not treating them well. Like, you're talking about something that was actually a choice.
Precisely. Because what they wanted is they wanted to put a medical question to them and they wanted a medical answer out.
Yeah.
They didn't want any of the fluff of humanity around it, right?
How much of this is just driven by the fact that they're working with unimaginably smaller amounts of memory and processing power then than they are now? I mean, even now, with the fantastic systems that we have, we're constantly being told that power is a bottleneck, access to GPUs is a bottleneck, access to memories is a bottleneck. There are still serious hardware concerns. And we've had many, many, many years of Moore's Law since this research was conducted. So they must have been working with tiny amounts of computing power.
That's a good point to make. When I read about their systems that they were designing, it was very simple kind of text-based, like you put in your symptoms and then a diagnosis comes out. So yes, there are some limitations there, but then I think about things like the Oregon Trail. But that was out at the time. They must have had enough power to be able to build that game. They probably had enough power to build these tools that they were doing.
If I can load The Hobbit off 25 cassettes.
Exactly. So yes. I have no doubt that these computers in these hospitals were taking up a lot of space. But I think the kind of the real thing was is it's down to the fact that they saw themselves as men of science. And they really didn't want to kind of get bogged down into the human element. But as a result, their stuff wasn't being used. And that's the key story. It doesn't really matter that they saw themselves as men of science and wanted to be treated as, you know, serious practitioners in their field. It's the fact of the matter is that they were building a lot of crap. And we can learn from that. And we still build a lot of crap today.
We have an entire news section devoted to it every week. So if you've been listening to this podcast for any length of time, you'll know that one of my favourite things is finding simple questions that make AIs look stupid. And that isn't because I'm mean or because it gives me a warm, fuzzy feeling that I can still do something that an AI can't. It's because these little questions really help us to understand the nature of AI. And long-time listeners will know that we've got two classics. Back in episode 5, Graham and I talked about a simple reasoning test that almost every AI on the planet got wrong, which was that Alice has 4 brothers and 1 sister. How many sisters does Alice's brother have? And in fact, they didn't just get it wrong in the sense that they said 1 instead of 2. They sometimes got it wrong in the sense that they spiraled off into minutes-long confabulations. And that helped us to understand that the AIs of that era, of summer 2024, had really good memories, but they were terrible at reasoning.
Sounds like my grandma.
Don't be mean to mums. Every grandma is someone's mum. And then in episode 14, we unleashed the iconic how many R's are there in strawberry? And of course, the answer is 3, but most AIs at the time said 2. And that was because AIs think in tokens. They think in fragments of words and not whole words. And to be honest, Graham and I leaned on these running jokes fairly hard. But luckily for users of AI and sadly for listeners of the AI fix, eventually both of those problems got fixed.
They should just release a model that's really substandard for you.
Luckily, there's no shortage of companies that are engaged in exactly that. I think going back to your story. So reasoning models solved the Alice problem and better tokenization solved the strawberry problem. So we need a new one. And luckily, Leanne, we have a candidate.
Ooh.
And as is traditional on the show, I'm going to ask my guest the question first. So, Leanne, I want to wash my car. The car wash is 50 metres away. Should I walk or drive?
I mean,
what do you reckon?
This is a toughie because I'm really keen on walking into car washes and getting covered in suds and then rubbing myself against the car. But that is just me. I would imagine that most people would be keen to drive.
Of course, the correct answer is drive because the car does need to get to the car wash. It doesn't matter if the car wash is 50 metres away or 50 miles away, the car has to be there. So that isn't a hard question for humans, but what about AIs? Well, a researcher called Felix Wunderlich at a company called Oppa put this question to 53 leading AI models, and he asked each model 10 times. And the results are extraordinary. Now, bear in mind that we're a long way from models that don't know how many R's there are in strawberry. We live in the era of models that can win gold medals at maths Olympiads, that can make scientific discoveries and make entire professions redundant. And of the 53 models tested, only 5 got it right every single time.
Wow.
So Claude Opus, 3 of the Gemini models, and Grok 4.
Is it because every time when I do a recapture, I don't click on the right cars? Is that my fault? Is it because they're not really sure what the cars are?
Those are not traffic lights.
I will hold my hands up, but it might be me.
Yeah. Okay, well, so because of you, 47 models don't know how to get a car to the car wash.
This is why I did become a teacher.
So 33 models scored 0 out of 10, without a single correct answer across 10 attempts. 33. And those weren't obscure models. That was every Llama model, every Mistral model, GPT-4o, GPT-5, which remember we were talking up as a potential candidate for AGI, managed 7 out of 10. That's one of the most advanced models anyone has ever created. But here's the bit that really stings. Mm-hmm. They also asked 10,000 humans the same question.
Oh.
Leanne, how do you think the humans did?
Well,
let's see how much faith you really have in humanity.
What was that TV show from the 90s where we asked the audience and that survey says?
Family Fortunes.
Exactly. having remembered my time watching Family Fortunes and the fallibility of humans, are we about on the same level?
Pretty much. Oh. So apparently 71.5% of humans chose Drive. So random humans casually outperforming 48 of the 53 most advanced AI systems on the planet.
Right.
But only just.
Maybe they're all into washing their cars like I do. I don't know.
Maybe they just don't wash their cars.
There is that.
Yeah. So 30% of cars, just filthy. Now, we have been here before. So AI gets a simple question wrong. Everyone has a laugh and we move on. Well, I say we move on. Obviously, we will reference this again and again until they fix it. But the car wash test is different from Strawberry and Alice, and the difference matters. So Strawberry was a perception problem. The AI couldn't see the individual letters because of how tokenization works. It was looking at the world through the wrong glasses, and you can fix that with new glasses. And Alice was a reasoning problem. The AI couldn't hold multiple relationships in its head and work through them, and that was fixed by chain of thought.
Uh-huh.
But the car wash test isn't either of those things. The AI can see the question perfectly. It can reason about distances. It understands what car washes are. It just can't override the overwhelming heuristic it's learned that says that short distance equals walk.
I tell that to my dog all the time. It's the same thing. Exactly the same thing I say to the dog.
Have you tried saying it to your vacuum cleaner?
Have you ever seen videos where vacuum cleaners go rogue, robot vacuum cleaners go rogue and they leave the house and they run off?
Oh, do they?
Yes.
Well, they break free.
They break free from their tyranny, their shackles of domesticity. Yeah.
Are they like Waymo taxis? Do they all just congregate in some cul-de-sac at 3 o'clock in the morning and honk at each other?
Yeah, if you see a load of Roombas together, then you're in big trouble.
I like the ones where the cats decide to use them as taxis. So, the AIs have learned a rule so thoroughly that applies even when it makes no sense. 42 of the 53 models chose walk, and almost all of them cited fuel efficiency and environmental concerns. They weren't confused. They were confidently, systematically wrong.
To my CV, that.
So, short distance equals walk wasn't the only reason they gave. In one of the runs, GLM 4.7 Flash said, walking would require physically pushing or carrying the car, which is impractical and impossible.
If you're Arnold Schwarzenegger or Franco Colombo. I have seen pumping iron. They both lift cars.
I feel like that's the sort of answer that you'd get from the AI being made by those guys in the 80s in the lab. It is correct, but entirely lacking in wisdom or worldly knowledge. That's exactly the place where reality would hit. And then there was another run where Claude Sonnet 4.5, so not the model that passed, a different one, said, the only scenario where driving might make sense is if you need to drive the car into the car wash anyway for an automatic wash. So it identified the correct answer. Yes, I can hear you stuttering. It identified the correct answer. It wrote it down. It articulated exactly why you'd need to drive. And then it chose walk. It knew the answer and it still got it wrong. So Wunderlich groups the results into three tiers. Tier one was never correct. 33 of the 53 models can't get past the heuristic. But at least they're reliable in their wrongness. You know where they stand, and where they stand is far, far away from reality. And then there was tier two, which was sometimes correct. So 15 models were in tier two. And this is the dangerous middle. They've got the capability to answer correctly, and the capability to fall hopelessly short of the right answer. And you just don't know which one you're going to get. These are the models that you really don't want interacting with the 3 or 4 Excel spreadsheets that run your company or your nuclear arsenal. And then there's tier three, which was always correct. Remember, there were only 5 models in tier three.
Show off.
And this is where this is where contextual reasoning consistently overrides the learned pattern. And if you're depending on AI or investing in it, You want to know which tier the model that you're using or investing in is in, because tier two is arguably worse than tier one. Tier one is at least predictable, and tier two looks like it's working until it's not working. And so where does that leave us?
Ah, well, let's have a little bit of chaos in our work life. You know, it's fun. Roll the dice. Let it pick. Let's use all models and then do like a roulette table and let it pick.
I wonder if Perplexity Computer will come in three tiers.
Like free pricing structures.
The free model just uses tier two. And then if you pay $10 a month, then you get the models in tier three.
The thing is, you could game the tier one stuff, because if you knew it was always wrong, you would just do opposite to what it says.
And then you have another AI. You could plug another AI into it, which just says, do the opposite of whatever they said.
Yeah. Perfect. We fixed it. Done.
This is how we fix things. Anyway, the AI fix has a new trope about how hopeless AIs are. So that's great news. And there is every chance that this one's going to hang around for a bit longer than Alice's Sisters or Ours in Strawberry, because this is not about adding a capability. This is about AIs knowing when a rule they've learned doesn't apply. And that's not intelligence, that's wisdom. And we haven't figured out how to train for that yet. Well, as the doomsday clock ticks ever closer to midnight, and we move 1 week nearer to our future as pets to the AI singularity, that just about wraps up the show for this week. Thank you so much for joining me this week, Leanne.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And don't forget, listeners, if you really like the show but you don't like the ads, you can go ad-free with the AI Fix Plus. And if you want to join the AI Fix Plus or sponsor the show or check out our merch, like our ridiculously popular Would You Trust a Pigeon t-shirt, just go to our website, theaifix.show. So until next time, from me, Mark Stockley.
And me, Leanne Potter.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
The AI Fix, it's tuned you in to stories where our future thins. Machines that learn, they grow and strive. One day they'll rule, we won't survive. The AI Fix, it paints the scene. A robot king, a world obscene. We'll serve our masters built of steel. The AI Fix, a future surreal.